Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to 2019's first episode of Endeavors. Apologize for the sound of my voice, I'm a little bit sniffly right now. What a great way to start the new year, eh? But, that being said, it's a very, very fantastic show for everyone to listen to today. I have University professor Martin Worthington, and he did something very interesting. He teaches, one of the things he teaches is ancient Babylonian in the UK, and him and his students did this project. They shot a short film entirely in ancient Babylonian, and as a film buff and a language buff, I couldn't have contacted him quickly enough. So we'll hear about how that all came about and what he learned about the filmmaking process, and if he has any more plans to do any other films in ancient languages. And then you'll also hear from another filmmaker, this one a little closer to home, right here in Toronto. Justin McConnell, who is the director of the horror film Life Changer. And a lot of horror films come out at the beginning of January, and I'll talk with Justin about why he thinks that is, and how he thinks Life Changer maybe tilts the horror genre on its head a little bit. But first, here is my conversation with Dr. Martin Worthington. Dr. Martin Worthington, hello. Thanks for being here this evening.
Hello. Lovely to meet you.
So I wanted to have you on because you spearheaded a very interesting project. You did the world's first film entirely in ancient Babylonian, the Poor Man of Nippur. And I know in your Assyriology class at Cambridge, you and your students sort of read the poem and studied the poem, but when did the idea to dramatize it on film, how did that come to be?
It was a process with many twists and turns. The seed of the idea was actually planted by one of the students who went on to become one of the actors, who, walking out of the class after we'd been reading it as part of their course, said it would be fun to dramatize this. And, you know, the idea sort of sat at the back of all our minds and probably nothing would have happened with it. Except that at the same time, in my college, there was someone who was organizing a dramatization of something in ancient Greek, which I was taking part in. And seeing all these people excitedly declaiming ancient Greek and thinking, gosh, well, they're going to have an audience, I started to think, well, actually, maybe we could do it as well. And, you know, there was already the suggestion of the Poor Man of Nippur. And then, but, you know, if we do it like a play, we do it one evening, everything has to be perfect, and will people come, will they not? It's a lot of effort. Of course, if we filmed it, then it's, you know, on record for a certain amount of time. So actually, we could dispense with the play and, oh my goodness, make a film. And you have to understand, this was still all very much in a ha, 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 wouldn't it be nice if idea, until a colleague of mine, who's now at the University of Durham, Dr. Catherine Stevens, said, well, actually, I could get some funding for this. And so Catherine got the first dollop of funding, and suddenly it was going to happen. And we were all absolutely flabbergasted. It was like, what have we got ourselves into? But more money arrived, and we got more and more serious. And, you know, then it sort of became a massive snowball rolling down the hill that we were unable to stop.
Given that the film is in a language that hasn't been spoken in over 2,000 years, how did you go about getting the proper text and making sure that everything was pronounced correctly?
Well, there is always going to be a certain amount of guesswork about the pronunciation of a dead language because nothing can be proved absolutely beyond doubt. But Babylonian was deciphered, roughly 150 years ago, more like 160 now. And lots of people have been working on lots of aspects of this question. The simple answer is that we actually have transcriptions of Babylonian words into the Greek alphabet and into the Hebrew alphabet, so that if you know how to pronounce those alphabets, that gives you a big window onto how to pronounce Babylonian words. Added to that, it's a member of the Semitic family, along with Hebrew, Arabic, Phoenician, Aramaic, Ethiopic, and other fun languages. And particularly the consonants of these languages tend to be fairly stable. So, as it were, if you have some idea of the others, then you have a fairly good idea of what you're going to be looking for in Babylonian. So, the third strand is that if you study Babylonian spellings very carefully, spellings can be a clue to pronunciation. So if you mix all of these three things together, you end up with a model of how the language is pronounced, which is sort of the standard model that all the universities in the world that teach this use. And so we simply made sure that our students were well-versed in that.
Here you are, you're a university teacher, and all of a sudden you're directing a film with non-professional actors and a live animal. Talk about the experience just for you of actually telling, you know, directing something that you might thought you would never do in your lifetime.
Yes, quite so. If anybody had told me a year earlier that we were going to be doing that, I'd probably laughed at them. Well, first of all, this whole thing worked so well, you know, if it worked well, but people seem to think so, because lots and lots of people gave of their time. We had two fantastic PhD students, Pierre Batouissouk and Sylvia Ferreri, who were magnificent in practicalities and getting costumes from A to B and working out who had to be where. And so from the very beginning, I didn't feel that this was me telling a load of people what to do. I felt that I was part of a team where everybody had a different role. And I think psychologically that was a massive help. It meant I didn't go mad. Then we had professional camera people and the professional video editor. So there were sensible people on hand to say, well, how about this and how about that? That sounds totally ridiculous. And in fact, because I was sort of getting quite excited about this whole film thing, I think the scene in the King's Garden, it was the first thing we shot, and we were there for something like 4 hours. And, you know, we did it quite well, or at least we were quite pleased with it. But the cameraman pointed out, well, look, if you're going to do every 10-second scene at the rate of 4 hours, we're going to be here for weeks on end, so you might want to hurry up. For me, they were some of the most fun and the most demanding, exhausting weeks of my life. At the end, I could barely stand up. But the whole thing was a riot. There were so many different aspects to be taken into account. You know, do we have permission to film? What about the costumes? What about the lines? What about the script? What about locations? And everything kept changing, more or less up to the last minute. yes, it was massive fun.
Just curious from a historical perspective and a diversity perspective, given that Nippur is in modern day Iraq, was there some concern that perhaps history wasn't being represented 100% ethnically correct?
Well, if someone were to put that to me, I would say I completely see the sense of the question. And I very much hope that further films will be made by Iraqi students and scholars, either by themselves or in collaboration with other people. And certainly that Iraqi scholars will be able to have the agency to enjoy and participate in the perpetuation of their current cultural heritage in this manner. That would be fantastic. On the other hand, you know, I teach Assyriology in England, and it was something we thought we could do and would be fun to do. So we certainly mean no disrespect to anybody, and if what we've done can pave the way for somebody else to do more, that would be wonderful.
I noticed another interesting thing is that you had subtitles in, I think it's 16 different languages. How did that come about, and what kind of work went into translating into all those different cultures and different languages?
Well, I have to confess that with quite a lot of the languages, I'm unable to read the translation. So the whole cultural dimension is fascinating, and much of it is beyond my reach. Quite a few of the translators said, well, you know, I might have to explain this or I might have to put this in brackets. So at the beginning of the story, it said that his grain bins are bereft of Nisaba the Pure, Nisaba being one of the Mesopotamian grain goddesses. So what it means is he had no grain in his grain bins. And in preparing the English translation, we decided, well, you know, what the composition says is Nisibis, so we'll just say that. Some of the translators said, I think I'd prefer to gloss this. And I said, look, that's your responsibility. Feel free. You know, you are the master of your language, so go ahead and do it. Again, in the same way that making the film itself encountered an enormous amount of goodwill from so many people, so it was in the subtitles. I can't remember at which stage it was that we suddenly realised, hang on a sec, because the film is in Babylonian that needs to be translated from scratch into English, in the same way it can be translated into more or less any other language that YouTube allows. YouTube doesn't allow translations into Babylonian, which is quite annoying, so we can't have, as it were, original subtitles. But so then we started knocking on the door of friends and colleagues across the world, and fortunately, it isn't such an enormous job to translate it. You know, it's probably the work of 3 to 5 hours, which is a big effort, and we're very grateful. But we weren't asking people to go away and write a book, for example. And it was a quirky project. Luckily, between us, we had a lot of friends and colleagues in lots of different countries. And I think every person we asked actually said, OK, I'll do it. And so it happened, and we're very pleased. And of course, this means that, let's say, a part of Babylonian culture and the way of representing Babylonian culture, which is uncommon, is now accessible to a very large number of people. So that's also an objective where we're happy that could collectively be fulfilled.
I wanted to ask you about the music, because I saw that it was done by Steph Connor, and I actually had a chance to interview Steph about 4 years ago, I would say now. When you first decided that you were going to do this, was she somebody that you had reached out to straight away, given the type of music she's done in the past?
Well, absolutely. In 2010, the institution I was at the time released a website of recordings in Babylonian of various bits of poems. And Steph actually found the website and very impressively went on to record an album called The Flood, where she was singing Babylonian songs to instrumentation of her own composition. And as a result of this, we established contact and we became quite friendly. And so when we started making this film, I think at the very beginning, we hadn't actually got as ambitious as having a proper soundtrack and music. But as soon as the word music was uttered, then it was absolutely obvious that we should ask Steph Connor. And we asked with some trepidation because it was a very big job. And with enormous generosity, she said, all right, I will. And it was wonderful. I mean, the music, I think, is one of the best things about the film. And Steph has been an enormous asset. So, you know, our gratitude to her is immense, and I hope she gets due credit for it.
I wanted to ask about, we mentioned the fact you had a live animal on set. What was the biggest challenge about filming with a goat?
Well, actually, procuring it was quite a big challenge. There was a labyrinthine process. I went to an NHS farm and met some Ethiopic goats, which are absolutely enormous and probably too large to control, so they didn't work. We tried a vet. I tried the British Goat Association. I didn't know one existed, but it does. And in the end, it was a friend of a friend of a friend who said, well, try Hemsall's Community Farm. So I rang them up, and in this rather surreal way, which I've now become accustomed to presenting the project, I said, hello, I'm an Assyriologist at the University of Cambridge, and we're making a film in ancient Babylonian, and do you happen to have a goat? And the gentleman replied, well, do you know what? I have one that's fully insured and licensed for educational purposes. So could you bring it on Friday? Of course I can. And so he came, and there was the goat that you see in the film, who's called Florence, and then there was her little friend who came to keep her company. And so one of our PhD students suddenly found himself improvised as a shepherd, carrying the little goat around from one part of the set to another, which is a very Mesopotamian thing to be doing. So we decided it was a good professional training.
And I noticed that in the credits, one of your students is the goat whisperer. How did they feel about that? And what did that entail? Just sort of being a handler?
Yes. So the person in question is Serena Povia, who is not actually one of my students, but she's a great friend of Assyriology, and she's also a member of my college. And when the film was happening, Serena enthusiastically said that she'd be happy to come on board. And when the two goats arrived, it sort of became obvious, as it should have been to us before, that they required a certain amount of coaxing and looking after and keeping entertained. And so Serena said, leave it to me. And so off she went, and she did a fantastic job. And so, of course, Goat Whisperer is tongue-in-cheek, but I think it's it conveys one of the things that Serena did for the film.
I was reading a few of the comments after I watched the film on YouTube, and I think one of the comments jokingly said, hey, maybe you can do the Epic of Gilgamesh next. Any plans for future films in either Babylonian or Sumerian or any of those other languages?
Well, it's funny you should ask. In fact, in the very same year that we released The Poor Man of Nippur, the University of Bern in Switzerland released a film in Sumerian, which is publicly accessible. So clearly both of us were sort of capturing the zeitgeist, and it's quite possible that there'll be further developments. I think Gilgamesh would be a pretty difficult one to do. It's very long. I think lots of people like to read it, but if they were confronted it as a film, I think lots of people might find it quite alien to what they're used to seeing. We'd very much like to do another one. It will partly depend on funding. It will also depend on having the right combination of people in place at the right time. I mean, we were enormously lucky with everybody that was on hand to make this particular film. But I have a sort of daydream of making the next one in Morocco. Because places like Fez, they have a city wall, they have the deserts, they have flat houses. So they probably look quite a lot like an ancient Mesopotamian city. And in fact, airfares are surprisingly cheap from England to there. But so far, this is a pipe dream. So far, we're quite pleased with the reception that we've had for this. It seems to have gone down well. Let's take a breather, and there may well be a take two. And I think Sumerian would be fun.
It seems now, and it's, you know, with you mentioning the film in Bern, that in the last, you know, decade, couple of decades, there's been a real sort of revived interest in a lot of these dead languages, biblical languages, you know, biblical documents, that sort of thing. From a educational perspective or historical perspective, why do you think that is?
Well, it's very interesting. Lots of people who choose what to do at university never think that they might do, say, the languages of ancient Mesopotamia, simply because they're not aware that they exist. Everybody's heard of Greek and Latin, lots of people have heard of ancient Egyptian, but there seems to be a sort of line in the sand beyond that point that people don't cross. And of course, one of the points of making this film was to bring it to people's attention that these languages exist. And as you say, this is an ongoing enterprise that lots of people in different fields are taking part in. I think people are simply fascinated by the past, and they're also fascinated by language itself. If you just listen to people chit-chatting, you know, often they comment on each other's language and the way they say things and the way other people say things. It just seems to be one of the way humans are wired up, probably because language is so instrumental to the whole fact of being a human being. So the combination of language and the past and the sheer magic of these ancient civilizations, which on the one hand it can be romantic to orientalize, the mysterious Assyrians in their great palaces, and of course on the other hand they're just people like us who lived and died and loved and ate and had hopes and ambitions and tilled the soil and perpetuated themselves and reproduced. So there's a fantastic experience of studying the civilizations. You suddenly come face to face with clay tablets that mention names you know, like Cyrus or Darius, and those are the late ones. Then there are ones that mention Hammurabi, as in Hammurabi's law code, and they go back over 1,000 years earlier. And being part of all this is simply intellectually hugely exciting. And so it's good if some of that rubs off onto the general public.
For you, what was the most interesting thing that you learned about the filmmaking process?
I can certainly tell you some of the things I've learned about, as it were, the performance of Babylonian literature. So one of the things that I try to do in my teaching is to try and teach Babylonian as an actual language. We don't yet try and have conversational classes in it. That's all rather complicated because a lot of the sources don't give us the phrases we would need to have what you and I would consider a normal conversation. But certainly I get my students to read it out, to say it to themselves, and to try and make up the odd sentence here or there. We're even at some point considering playing Settlers of Catan in Babylonian, because all the sentences you need, like who will give me two sheep for one rocks, are things that students in their second or third year ought to be able to say. I'm losing my thread, but I'm moving towards the whole question of this oral dimension to Mesopotamian sources. So if you simply read Babylonian literature on the printed page, you often don't take thought for the various possibilities that recitation allows. And the best example I've ever seen of this was in Shakespeare in Richard III, when there's a scene where Richard III is trying to seduce a lady, and her reply is, "Well, my dear chap, you know, you've killed all my friends and you've been absolutely horrible to me. How could I possibly countenance this?" And his reply starts with the word "but." And, you know, he goes on to say, "Ah, but, you know, take me, whatever." And a performance I saw of this, the actor said, "But," and everybody in the audience erupted with laughter. It was a way to discharge the tension and let the seriousness of the scene start again. And, of course, he was doing nothing that was incompatible with what was written on the page, because the page said "but," and he said "but." But he had the vision to say it in a way that wouldn't occur to most people. And so how much scope is there in Babylonian for doing things like that? And so, for example, the very last line of the story is "the mare entered the city crawling." And a lot of people find that a bit flat. And in the process of making the film, we realised, well, actually, it could be "the mare, ... he entered the city crawling." And that's much more effective. Of course, it's not how you'd simply read it naturally if you're just sitting there reading it to yourself. It's all about performance. But that's exactly what one of the things that we learnt, that there's enormous scope for, as it were, fine-tuning the import of the phrasing. And I think there's a lot of scope for serious study of that. So that's one of the things that came out of making the film, that we learnt about the story.
Well, the film is The Poor Man of Nippur. I had a chance to watch it. I am fascinated by it, and I'm going to tell all my friends and all my listeners to go and find it on YouTube. Dr. Martin Worthington, thanks so much for your time this evening, and congratulations on a great film.
Thank you so much for your time and for all your listeners who take the trouble to listen to us. Have a very nice day.
All right, you too. Ciao.
That was Dr. Martin Worthington, who teaches the Akkadian and Sumerian language, as well as courses on Mesopotamian literature, religion, and scholarship at Cambridge University. He was also the director of the short film Poor Man of Nippur, which is said to be the first short film ever shot entirely in ancient Babylonian. You can find the film now on YouTube, and Nippur is Nippur. Well, from ancient Babylonia to modern day, my next guest is also a filmmaker, albeit this is in the horror genre. He just had a film recently released entitled Life Changer, which is part horror, part love story about a shapeshifter, I guess we will put it. The film is Life Changer, and the director is Justin McConnell. And I spoke with him in Toronto before the new year about the film. Justin McConnell, hello. Good afternoon. How you doing, man? So, Life Changer. It's funny because I was reading the synopsis of it, and it says, you know, a guy who has to inhabit a different soul every couple of days, otherwise he dies. And then in another view, I read that described him as a homicidal shapeshifter.
Sure. Have you seen the film?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, like, I have the, I was...
You were sent the press materials.
Sent the press materials, yeah. Trailer. I just haven't had a good chunk of time to sit down and watch the whole screener yet. But, yeah.
So do you want me to describe?
Yeah, yeah. My question was, I guess, how would you see the lead character, Drew?
He's somebody that has a condition that every block of time, depending on how old he is or what substances he's taking or what injuries he's got, has to find somebody because his body's rotting away and drain their entire essence and become them and then leave them as a husk and a body to dispose of. So every once in a while, he's got to become, literally become somebody else for a period of time until that body decays away.
Right.
So it's always a ticking clock. And the story starts in a place where he's dying, or he thinks he's dying, and this change is coming faster and faster and faster. So he's having to be desperate and find people without getting caught quicker and quicker and quicker.
And as always, there's a woman involved. Would you?
I don't know if that's always, but yes.
Well, in this case, yes. Yeah. Would you consider Life Changer a love story of sorts in any way?
Not really. I mean, it's marketed as a love story, and the love is a big part of it, but it's very one-sided. So it's much more of an obsession tale, or a stalking tale,
right.
Or that trope stalking as love, but in a way that condemns it and doesn't make it. It's not like an 80s romantic comedy movie where
right.
the guy does everything and, you know, all these terrible things, and then, but at the end of it, he's got the girl, so it's all okay. It's more about somebody causing a lot of damage in the pursuit of love, and the person he's in love with not even knowing he exists.
Right.
So, yeah.
The classic, like, teenage boy infatuation type of love, right?
Yeah, taken to a psychotic
And what's interesting is I was I read something on I think it was the Sci-Fi website that described your film as unabashedly feminist.
Well, it definitely takes a stance on that. I would say it's one part of a bigger story.
Sure.
But I think the approach I would use is that while writing it, from the first draft until the draft we shot, I was doing a lot of introspection and self-analysis and thinking about how I was in my 20s and how relationships were for me and how I sort of, you have to learn how to be in a relationship. And at the same time, the Me Too movement was really getting very vocal and very, like, raising up. So I was reading a lot, and I was, because I try and read everything I can. And it's led to a lot of analysis of my past actions and relationships. And I took sort of the ugly parts I saw in myself and exaggerated them to a psychotic, sociopathic degree. Maybe as a way of cleansing it, but also as a way of just making a statement. And there is a degree of that social, sexual, political subtext to it. And people have picked up on it. I mean, when you watch the film, it's pretty obvious.
Right.
But it's one part of a larger worldview that the character both has and isn't aware he has.
You know, you mentioned the Me Too movement and sort of this big, I guess, social shift that we've seen over the last, you know, couple of years. And I'm curious, as a storyteller,
sure.
How do you think this cultural movement has changed the way we as a society view relationships, and not just like the love and sexual relationships, but also just like, you know, personal relationships amongst friends.
I think it's leading to a lot of confusion as people find their way and try and understand what's right and what's wrong, and what, you know, anybody who's introspective or anybody who's self-evaluating and you know, wants to improve as a person or is going to notice patterns in their past that, you know, may or may not have been the healthy thing. But I think a lot of that on an internal level happens naturally for a large section of people. But what this movement has done is put it in the forefront, and it's made people have to sort of like force to confront whatever toxicity they might have or whatever else. But it's also just very, it's so prevalent, it's so ubiquitous that it's hard not to face it, like run into the conversation all the time.
Right.
But in the long road, it's changing. I think it's just changing the dynamic between the sexes and making us reevaluate sort of the approach to relating to somebody, not necessarily just of the opposite sex, but relating to somebody who you're trying to figure out the boundaries of whatever that relationship is, whether it's friendship or relationship or something sexual or otherwise. It's reclassifying the boundaries, and I think it's a healthy thing for society. I think there's always going to be resistance to it, and I think it may overstep its bounds in some places, but that's a growing pain. It's always going to be, for a while at least, it's going to be difficult to
understand where the boundaries are and where does the line, where's the line that's always ever shifting. I think that there was that Hannah Gadsby article or essay or whatever. It was the same sort of thing. I mean, I read all this stuff. I think anybody who is alert and awake to some degree, male or female, whatever. I don't want to consider myself to be somebody who's like actively pushing an agenda. I just consider myself somebody who is open-minded enough to recognize flaws and want to push a better ideal of relationships forward.
It strikes me that, especially within the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of horror films that are very, you know, socio-aware. Like they always seem to be on the cusp of some, you know, new socio-political movement or change.
Sure.
What is it about that genre, do you think, that it maybe is conducive to that sort of and that type of awareness?
Well, I mean, if you're looking historically, horror has always reflected the sociopolitical turmoil or the sociopolitical issues of the given time that a horror film is made. Night of the Living Dead was a reflection of the civil rights movement, although not intentionally so, but it built into that, and that was definitely informed by that. We'll just stick with Romero. The consumerist culture in Dawn of the Dead is on full display. It's always traditionally been some reflection. At least the ones that seem to live on are the ones that seem to really impact. It's always been sort of a reflection of the social and political issues at the time. So I think a lot of things is that writers of horror largely are finding a way to sort of purge ideas and to take their stories in a way where they can, whatever thought, not every horror film does this, obviously. There's straightforward slashers and there's so many different types, but the ones that are political, the ones that reflect that politics, is usually the writer, it's what's on the top of their mind because they're living it. So they are telling stories based on the society they're living in at a given time. And we've been going through what we're going through right now, so you're getting films like Get Out, and you're getting films, you know, things that are very representative. But if you look historically, Get Out's nothing new, right? Like, these issues have been around for a long, long period of time, and to say that they're reflecting our times, like, you go back to the late 80s, and there's lost films like Sam Furstenberg's Riverbend, which is it's not a horror film, it's an action film, but it sort of takes the same kind of approach to race relations and things like that. Like, this stuff has been going on, you know, you got Mississippi Burning, you've got, you know, it is absolutely, I just think if you're not paying attention, you don't notice these things, but the moment that enough people are loudly making these points in their films, sure, then all of a sudden, oh, it's a movement. But it's been, historically, it's been going on forever.
And it's interesting that I find that maybe this is a certain amount of ignorance, but that there are things that are done in horror films that couldn't be done in another genre or another type of medium. Is that because people have this idea of horror that it's already going to be over the top anyway, and so it filmmakers are in that sense maybe more daring?
Possibly. I think it's entirely possible that horror filmmakers they're willing to take risks and go in those directions because, yes, the audience is already primed for an experience that they have to keep their mind open anyway, because usually it's dealing with the fantastical or maybe things that could happen in real life but happen to such a small, finite number of people that it becomes difficult to extrapolate that in your own experience and go, okay, yeah, no, I'm definitely going to live through that shark attacking me or whatever it is. But I always look at horror as a big umbrella. It's a big catch-all that sort of, you could tell any story you want to under the canopy of horror, and it allows the audience to already be ready for the experience, and then if you're going to put a message into that experience, they're already receptive to the actual experience of sitting down and watching something. So it might be, it might just be that it's like a Trojan horse, right? You have the horse itself is the experience of, like, there's this monster out to get us or whatever it is, and then the soldiers on the inside are the message. And I think, yeah, maybe it's to do with it's to do with the idea that the horror filmmakers in general, they may want to make a point, they may not want to make a point, but at the end of the day, you're dealing with this sort of situation where, how do I put this the best way? You are wanting to experience something new, and you're open to an idea being given to you, and that openness, it sort of allows you to put a lot of other different story elements and a lot of different other points into one package, I guess. But there's lots of genres that have had, you know, socio-political commentary going into them. You find it in action films, you find it in sci-fi, but largely genre. Like, there's dramas, but their point will be, the entire point of the film will be that message.
Yeah, exactly.
But the horror might have a side message that happens to be, okay, well, this is really about the feeling of being a woman, or this is really about racism. But on the surface, it's this monster movie. So, it's hiding messages, I suppose.
I know this film did a long tour of the festival circuit, horror festivals are something else, because they are so. I think there's a different level and different kind of fandom that is associated with that, you know, versus something like TIFF or Sundance or any of sort of your non-genre based festivals. What have you noticed, and what do you like most about getting to know not just fans of your movie, but horror fans in general?
Well, we're the world's biggest family in a lot of ways. The same way that the metal scene has, you know, everybody can recognize a metalhead and we're all friendly with each other. It's the same sort of idea where the horror is an outsider's medium where a bunch of outsiders come together to be insiders. So it's sort of like... I forget what it was. There's this incendiary tweet that ran around or something talking about how horror fans are more likely to be sociopathic or whatever. And then there was this giant outcry from the horror community, and then a hashtag that was like, I'm a horror fan, and then everybody telling their experiences. And when you read that hashtag, it's like, yeah, it makes total sense. They were either marginalized, or they were, they grew up in a small town with not a lot of friends, or, you know, whatever drove them to the horror genre, it's usually people who are like-minded, and who aren't really in step with what's popular, and then horror becomes popular, but then the people who were already horror fans go a little bit further outside the mainstream. And I think it's like anything, it's like any fandom, it just so happens that horror is popular enough that no matter where you go in the world, there's going to be a vocal group of, it's like motorcycle gangs,
yeah,
or whatever. Like, there's going to be a group of people who are just so passionate about it, more so than anything else. And I went, you know, to South Korea and Barcelona and Finland, and you just walk in, it's like, I know who these people are. I grew up with people like this, and that's kind of a very heartwarming thing to know that there's all these people out there that support the genre. Not necessarily your film, not necessarily every film, but they are, as a whole, they support the idea behind the genre itself. So that's it's just a really nice feeling. But we didn't just play genre festivals. We also played, like, Busan is the TIFF of Asia. It's a much more mainstream festival. But in that, they have their horror sidebar. So they started our films, three films in a row, at midnight. Ours started at 2 a.m. and then Halloween played at 4 a.m. in front of 900 people or so. And it's like, well, that's the horror contingent in South Korea coming in. And there's a lot of them. And they're very, very passionate, and I think that's why I like the genre so much. You sit in a genre audience at a genre festival, it's a very different experience than sitting in a festival audience for a drama at TIFF or something like that.
Yeah.
They're all very quiet, reserved. They might not even clap at the end of the movie. A horror audience will be vocal, but not in a bad way. Like, they'll cheer and they'll clap and they'll laugh, but, you know, along with the film, actually, with the,
right,
the,
yeah,
you know, it's a very. It's a very welcoming family of weirdos, and I mean that in a very warm way.
Yes. You mentioned South Korea, and you know, I think the Asian market and the importance of the Asian market has really exploded within the last 10 years, let's say.
Yeah.
Roughly.
Yeah.
Having your film play internationally, and getting a response from an international audience whose first language is more often than not English.
Sure.
What is that feeling like for you as a filmmaker?
good. I mean, it's a really good feeling. I think it's great that to feel like you've made a movie that translates past English boundaries, that translates to other languages. And that's another reason that that horror is so popular around the world, is that the stories are generally universal. You make a comedy in the U.S., you make a comedy in Belgium, whatever, the humor is very regional. It's not going to play well outside of that region. Horror, on the other hand, has the themes and the topics that the entire world can get behind and can understand. Fear of death, fear of, the supernatural, because every single culture out there has some kind of a history with, supernatural folklore and that sort of thing. What would you do for survival? These sort of themes that are all universal. So a story that deals in those themes and deals in those topics will play across language lines. They can watch a horror film and even without the subtitles still sort of get the gist of it, which I think is a great equalizer. So when you go there and you realize people are passionately responding to your work, and they have a completely different background than you and they grew up in a completely different way, it's the same thing. It just makes you feel less alone in the world. And in that, somebody in South Korea or somebody in Mexico or somebody wherever can identify with what you're putting out in the world. It's a really, really good feeling.
I know Life Changer won Best Visual Effects here at Toronto After Dark.
Best Practical Effects, yeah.
And for a horror film, I feel like winning an award associated with effects is a really big deal, because so much of that style of filmmaking can be effect-based.
Yeah.
And obviously, winning any kind of award is nice, getting recognition. But
yeah, we've won a few for this one.
Winning an award like that in your home base
was a great feeling. I mean, also a weird feeling though too, because I am a programmer, Toronto After Dark. So it comes. I didn't think we were going to win anything because it didn't feel right. But it's all audience voted, so it has nothing. Like, even me playing the festival, I had no say in it whatsoever, because we have to step away. Like, Peter Kopleski, who was on our team, produced The Void, and Christian Burgess produced The Demolisher, and those films have all played. But every time something like that comes to the table, we have to walk away, and everybody else has to discuss. And I've been rejected from that festival that I work at several times. But winning an award felt like something different, where it was like, well, that's really cool, and I get it, because there's really great practical effects in the film. Done by really talented people that have nothing to do with me, but at the same time, it was like, I work for this fucking festival. What is this going to look like? But the way those awards are voted on is it's a survey of all the fans who came out. It has nothing to do with the organizers. So the fans voted for it. The people in the hometown voted for it. I accept it. But we've won three audience awards and two best director awards as well. And there's around the world, and there's a. There's been a really strong response, so if that was the only award we ever won, I would feel even weirder.
Fair.
Yeah.
You mentioned you won a couple of audience awards, which is, I guess, sort of like,
audience voted.
Favorite film of the festival,
picked
by the audience. And I guess in the mainstream you have the People's Choice Awards or
something like that.
Having that feeling again, coming from horror fans, knowing that out of all the films they saw, yours was the favorite.
Yeah, it's a dangerous and. Oops, sorry, I apologize. We're in a coffee shop right now.
It's okay.
An active coffee shop. It's both a great feeling and a dangerous one. It's a great feeling in that, I won this award and people chose it. It's a dangerous one because I've been a firm believer that you can't ever believe that you are even good at what you do as a filmmaker. You have to always be improving, and if you start believing your own press and sniffing your own shit and getting off on it, you become weaker as a filmmaker, and your future work is going to reflect that. You're not going to take criticism well, you're not going to take notes from your team, you're not going to take even the bad reviews to heart to a degree, because I always look at the bad reviews and go, okay, are there any points I agree with here? And if there is, I go, okay, maybe for the next one I'll think about that. So it's great, it's nice to be recognized, it's nice to put in the hard work and for the team to be recognized, and I believe the film is good. personally, but I'm also one opinion, and I can't let that get to my head, because if I do, my career's over before it's done, because I will never improve.
Right.
So I'm always learning, I'm always thinking that I can do better, even when I win awards, and even when we play a ton of festivals, and even when the film seems to be very successful, I have to be like, okay, great, but what could I have done to improve it, and what will I improve the next time I have to do it?
We mentioned Tron After Dark, and we also have Bits, Blood on the Snow, two great festivals. What do you make of the horror community in Toronto? Not just the filmmakers, but the people who enjoy the genre.
It's one of the strongest horror communities in the world, and I've been a lot of places in the world. I mean, there are strong horror communities everywhere, but the fact that you can go out on a given night in the city, any night of the year, and probably have to choose between one or two genre screenings, or as just as a cinephile, one or two or three, like, bucket list item, big screen presentations between the Royal and the Review and the Carlton, which is doing less indie stuff now, but used to do a bunch of it, and the Lightbox, you've always got a choice for something to see, to actually go out and see on the big screen that you would have loved to see as a kid, or you missed because you were too young, or whatever it is. There's always a chance to see something cool. And then you add all the festivals in the city, obviously Toronto After Dark, Blood in the Snow, my festival Little Terrors. Like, there's a bunch of genre, even like Japanese Toronto Film Festivals, Toronto Asian Film Festival, like they're bringing in genre stuff too. You're spoiled. It's an embarrassment of riches in this city when it comes to the horror community. Not just for screenings, but also Room Morgue is here. We've got Horrorama, the convention every year. There's always all kinds of events for horror fans. There's geek cafes popping up that have horror booths and horror rooms, like Seascape and the new mansion one. I forget what the hell it's called.
Stormcrow Manor?
Stormcrow
Manor. That's where I work.
Yeah, so Stormcrow Manor's got some horror stuff up on the walls. You know, you can go to Seascape and sit in a Hellraiser booth. Like, this city is very, very kind to the horror fan. So, and obviously there's Eyesore Cinema, which does screenings in their back room and has a massive horror catalog in their video store. The point being is, if you're a horror fan, Toronto is like a horror mecca. It's a place where you'll always find something to do, and you'll always find like-minded people who are into the genre. And if you're not finding those people, get the fuck out of your house.
I find it interesting, like, this film is opening up at the end of the month and into the new year. And it's always interesting, because I always come across a lot of horror films that open in the first week of January.
Sure, that's the dumping ground for a lot of studio stuff.
Largely, right. But I mean, like, yeah. What's the appeal, do you think, of starting the new year off with blood and guts and slasher?
I don't know. I don't know if it's really an active decision that people put horror films in January, because they're released all year round. I think a lot of it is they're just more difficult to market sometimes to certain audiences, and it's a quiet month for the blockbusters, so they'll put slightly smaller films, like we're talking studio level stuff here, they'll release slightly smaller films in the January-February zone before the summer movie season really kicks into gear in April, because they'll still get box office then. It's more of a barren landscape. There's still, especially the beginning of January, the stuff playing in theaters is the blockbusters that were released just before Christmas, and they're in their third or fourth weeks, so there's not a lot of competition. So it's usually those program films that had more modest budgets and or more word of mouth in that zone, because they have the best chance of a financial return. In the case of something like Life Changer, that's opening in Canada on the 28th of December, it also hits VOD on January 1st across North America. It was just timed that way, just to line up with the VOD dates, and so that the promotion, because the market is so oversaturated and there's so many films, an indie film like this can get lost. And you don't have that many kicks in the cans when it comes to actually promoting it. So you got to put it all in one block,
right?
And like hit it as hard as you can at once, and then hope it carries onward. And like, we have a Blu-ray DVD date a few months after our January 1st date, and that'll just be sort of like the word of mouth from the VOD will carry that over, and there'll be just a little bit of promotion for that, and then it comes out, kind of thing. So. I think it just depends on the type of film, but largely it's just because the calendar is more empty in January, so you're able to take more risks and maybe reap really big rewards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know one of the stars of your film is Laura Burke, and yeah. I had a chance to speak with her, I guess it was last year.
For Poor Agnes?
Yes. Yeah. And she's becoming somewhat of a bit of a local horror icon.
Well, I mean, two films, but yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's done two big films. I know she's done a few other horror things, but those are her big ones. Working with her, what was that experience like?
Great. She's an incredibly versatile actress or actor, whatever the proper terminology is. She absolutely got the project. She comes to set prepared. She is very giving as an actress, as a performer, in that the other performers feed off of what she's doing a lot. And she's able to turn on emotion, you know, on the drop of a hat. So she's a dream to work with. She's a very, very strong performer. And she's British, and you'd never know it.
I got that impression. Yeah, it's like, I heard a faint accent, but you're like, you don't really hear it that much.
Yep.
Well, the film is Life Changer. It's in theaters December 28th, and then VOD on January 1st.
That's right.
Justin McConnell, thanks so much for your time today, man.
No problem. Thank you.
And that was my interview with filmmaker Justin McConnell. His new movie, Life Changer, is out now. That does it for me today. My thanks to Martin Worthington and Justin McConnell. And thank you all for tuning in. I will catch you next time. Bye for now.